morning and welcome. This is Final Draft on 2SER 107.3. It is books, writing and literary culture every week for you. Now, my name is Andrew Papel, and if you've been tuning in recently, you'd know that we're enjoying a little bit of summer reading time here at Final Draft, getting ready for all of the amazing Australian books publishing. Around about now, there's a lot dropping in February, and I want to share a little bit of that with you. So this week is going to be a reprise of one of my favourite conversations from 2019, but it's also like this is the time of the year when being a book lover, it's getting real, it's ramping up, and I thought, I mean, maybe not all of you are as immersed in this as I am, and I want to help you get more immersed in just having books as what you live and breathe every single day. So I've got a few dates for your calendar, things to help you get excited, not just about new releases, but just about the amazing literary culture that we have here in Australia. So kicking us off is actually this week, the Stella Prize long list is going to be dropping. Now, the Stella Prize is an absolutely fabulous prize that is for an Australian woman writer for 2019. So the 2020 prize goes to 2019 works. So the long list drops. That is kind of your book club sorted for the year. It will be 12 books that you can discover. And if you're a really fast reader, you can discover them in time for the prize announcement in April. So pop the Stella Prize in your calendar. That's a great way to start off the year. Now, of course, if you're a lover of books, you've probably been that way since you were a child. And the Children's Book Council Awards are something that I remember from back when I was at primary school, and you'd borrow the books that had the little sticker on them. And look, the Children's Book Council announces their prize for books across a range of categories, from picture books and younger books through to young adult readers. And that shortlist is dropping at the end of March. So after you've gotten excited about the Stella Prize long list, and while you're waiting for that prize to drop, you can get excited. Books for your kids in March. There's also the Miles Franklin Award, and it is another great way to discover Australian writing. It is often described as the premier Australian Writing Award, award for Australian writers, and that long list drops in May. So the first 6 months of the year are some of our biggest prizes. So pop those. Pop those dates in your calendar to get excited for all of the books. Now, of course, you might want a little bit more than just discovering which books you should read. You might want to interact a little bit more with the authors themselves. And of course, that is something that I bring you every week on Final Draft, and I will continue to bring you that. But another great way to discover authors is from Sydney Writers Festival. Sydney Writers Festival it's been acknowledged as one of the greatest writers' festivals in the world. And every year I'm always very happy to be discussing and meeting and talking books with the amazing authors that come from around the world. And if you are getting excited for Sydney Writers Festival, the program for 2020 will be announced in March, which will give you a chance to, you know, draw up your list of things that you want to attend, check out the free events. They've always got so many. And buy your tickets, of course. And the festival will start on the 27th of April and run until the 3rd of May. So I think starting with the 6th of February, when the Stella long list drops, and heading all the way into May, when we've got Sydney Writers Festival, we have got you covered for plenty of book events. And you can always tune in every week to Final Draft or to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. Now, I want to tell you a little bit about some of the books that are coming up in February on the show. But first, I feel like I should share a little bit of what's to come on the show today. Now, one of my favourite novels from last year was Tara June Winch's The Yield. And today I want to reshare my conversation that I had with Tara last year when she was in Australia for a brief period. She now lives in France. And Tara is an amazing author. The Yield crosses three narratives exploring stories of dispossession of Australia's Indigenous inhabitants with invasion, and also the thriving meaning and surviving of culture and of language. It is just an incredible novel, and that's what I've got coming up on the show, so please stay tuned. We are going to take a short break before I come back with that conversation. After I have shared my conversation with Tara June Winch, I'm going to preview some of the books that you can look forward to across February. Spoiler alert, they're going to be awesome, and I really can't wait to help you meet some of those authors. But right now, I have got a track for you. This is from Melbourne band Cable Ties, and the track is called Sandcastle. See you after this. You are tuned in to 2SER 107.3. Now, this is Final Draft. It is books, writing and literary culture every week on your airwaves. Also, online, on your podcasting with Final Draft Great Conversations podcast. My name is Andrew Popel, and right now I have got a reprise of my conversation with Tara June Winch about her novel, The Yield. And The Yield is so much focused on language. I started off by greeting Tara in a slightly different way. Yamandumarang, Tara. I hope my pronunciation was okay there again.
It was, It was great.
I wanted to welcome you. I wanted to say thanks. And reading The Yield has been such a phenomenal experience for me. For the listeners who might not know what I just said, it was a Wiradjuri greeting. And as I read The Yield, you had me constantly thinking about this myth, this lie that I grew up with, that Australia is a monolingual country and that's why I only speak one language. But when I travel, I always try to learn a few words, even just to say hello and order a coffee. You do discuss this later in the book, that even just to say hello and use language is so much about respect for people and the people whose land you're visiting. And I felt like reading The Yield that this is a respect that had maybe been lacking in my entire life. And The Yield has helped me understand a bit of my responsibility there. But let's get into the book, because The Yield is told across three narratives. Albert Gondwindi's dictionary seeks to revive language and stories that he wants to pass on to his family when he dies. August, his granddaughter, returns to Prosperous House for the funeral of her grandfather, just as miners are arriving to plunder the land for tin. And through the letters of Reverend Ferdinand Greenleaf, we see exposed the racism and discrimination at the heart of the founding of Prosperous House a century earlier. Structurally, these interwoven chapters serve to gradually expose narrative elements across time, but in this relatively circumscribed space, these histories of massacre plans in Prosperous House almost seem to serve as a history of Australia. Why did you choose these styles and these stories to tell The Yield?
Well, I wanted to tell the story of Australia. That is probably why the book took so long, is because I was trying to be so broad in my focus. And when I did focus all of Australian history into those 500 acres on the banks of the fictional Murrumbi River, then I could see the characters that I would need to tell the story of all time in that space. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And in August's story, in August's return to Prosperous House, it forces her to confront the unknowns of the disappearance of her sister, Jetta. This is something that happened many years ago for her. She's been living in the UK for 10 years. This unknown history, it threads itself through Albert's story as well and the entire Gondwindi family. History that is unknown and unacknowledged is a big part of Australia and Australia's history. And in the story, it's acknowledged that there is truth there to be discovered about what happened to Jetta. And not confronting it leaves wounds open. What damage did you see being done to August growing up with these unknowns?
Well, August grows up with the residue of intergenerational trauma. It leads to a kind of sort of state of psychosis, in a sense. She's somewhere between two conceptual worlds in the thread of the Reverend Ferdinand, who is writing about, you know, the firm, unshakable timeline. He's referring to time all the time. In church sort of time, he's referring to dates and people who keep dates and keep, you know, structures of society in his view. And then you've got Poppy Albert Gondwindi, who is breaking the nature of time in a sort of magical realist way and is able to travel through the expanses of all time. And then August is kind of caught between these two worlds and is the product of these two histories on the same place, and it is such a burden for her. And I guess I felt in a lot of ways why August was the most difficult strand to write, is because it felt personal and it felt traumatic and horrifying to write her strand, to look at these histories really truthfully and look at how painful it is for generations who inherit, who have this terrible inheritance.
It's really clear how terrible this is, and also what a personal story it must have been for you. But if I can still talk a little bit more about August, I saw in her return, she also is forced to confront where she fits in her own history. And there's a part of the story where she's traveling to Sydney to a museum where artifacts are being held. She wants to get them back for her family, for her people. And she confronts these images and thinks of it, that these were real Aborigines, not like Auntie and her. This is a way of thinking that's permeated August's own self-conception. But it's that sort of idea of realness and authenticity seems to be a legacy of really racist ways of thinking. Is this Where are we at coming to terms with this? I feel like we're not, as a nation, coming to terms with it.
Absolutely. This is how she's experienced her society at her age and how it has, traversed other generations. Her mother is and her father are from this sort of lost generation, and her grandmother also feeling those effects. But she's from an extremely a part of the country that had extreme colonization, had there were massacres there. There was a war, a 100-year war. There was a lot of pain and a lot of blood spilled on that particular area of land. And there are a lot of broken links. And so many families from the Stolen Generation are from this part of Australia in particular. And I just wanted to show what that felt like down the line and how white Australians or everyday Australians that she grows up around, especially in these rural areas, have a perception of her unbelonging to the place that her family have belonged to for forever because they've grown up with these racist attitudes towards the First Nations people and because that was the narrative that they grew up with. They were taken away. They were... It's really complex to write these villainous kind of situations or these truth-telling episodes for August because there are all... So people are so multifaceted, that society, so there are good and bad. I don't want to, hark on that there's only one line being towed in this book because I've really tried to present a whole broad spectrum. It's really great to hear your interpretation of the book. And I do think it's true anyways, but I'm just sort of like, I think readers need to take... I think different readers will take what they take from this book, and that's what I really wanted them to do.
It's an extraordinary opportunity as a book to explore, though, and we've sort of barely touched on Albert's dictionary, but one thing that I learned so much from it, but one thing that it taught me is this idea of the yield. Bayana is not simply what's taken. We have this idea of a yield being something that, the land gives up, but also what's given. We learn that the Gondawindi were farmers. They cultivated the land long before. And I saw you're down in Melbourne for Melbourne Writers Festival, and on the lineup, Bruce Pascoe's in conversation with Tyson Yunkaporta. And I'm just getting into Tyson's book at the moment, but I wondered your thoughts around the ways traditional knowledges and understanding are now kind of, I'm going to use scare quotes to say, rediscovered in Australia, and how that sort of... aspect of it worked its way into the narratives of the yield.
The thing is that these stories have been around, these storytellers and even these great writers have been around for over a century now. Thousands and thousands of years, we're the original storytellers. People's voices, our people's First Nations voices, have been around forever. It isn't us that's changed. It's the reader that's changed. Mm. It's the fact that they're listening now. So, I mean, it's great. Publishers have a bit to do with that, the fact that they're taking risks in publishing these books and publishing them in a way that's pushing them into the viewing eye line, I guess, of the public. But these stories and these storytellers have been around forever, and they just haven't had the audiences that they're having. So, it is Australian readers that have changed, and for the better. But they need to change, not just on the page. They need to take stuff away from these books and talk about them, talk about these issues in communities, in their local schools, and in the way they vote, actually, because that's where the power is.
Yeah, and I think. I want to engage now with the third section of the book, the letter from the Reverend Ferdinand Greenleaf, his letter to the British Society of Ethnography. This section was one that I found particularly troubling, and it's probably because it's reflecting a white view, a worldview that perhaps I was brought up with, a lot of listeners will have been brought up with, where he talks of how wrongs became accepted as rights. But in his story, we also very, very much see how these ideas of protection, he sees himself as a good man doing, trying to do good things, but they quickly become another form of assimilation and destruction of culture in what he thinks he's doing to protect. He's actually just changing in a different way. Did you want this letter and the sections of this letter to say anything about seemingly well-meaning, progressive-type people who do miss the irony in that sort of parochial worldview?
Absolutely. I was writing to those portions of society that still exist that believe that the removal of children from their parents, from their birth parents, was for their own good. There are pockets of society that still believe that, and I was writing to those people to smack them over the head with the fact that even if you believed this, even if you believe it was for their own good or with the best intentions, nothing turned out well. Mm. You know, a culture was decimated, families were torn apart, and languages were lost. There was a denial of the mother tongue, which is a denial of the soul and the spirit and all history and all time. Yeah, I wanted to flip the idea of the villain on its head for those readers.
One of the things I really connected with, the way you have told stories and the importance of language, and I feel like we're still kind of talking off the interview here, because for me personally, language is something that's very important. This is a job that I do, but my day job, I'm a speech pathologist, and I work with children who are developing language, having trouble developing language, and I just see language as being such a, it's such a huge expression of self, but also identity. And one thing that I think I was challenged with a couple of years ago was how my practice, so I'm a speech pathologist, I'm white, I speak English, I only speak English. You know, like I said, I can order coffee in probably 10 different languages, but that's no good to anyone but me. And the idea, if I had a young Indigenous boy or girl come to me and need services, where my role, like where is the blurring of the line between the help that I'm trying to give and what I'm doing using a settler tongue in helping this person? And so to read your book and to have done a little bit of background research in the way different people are reviving and actually bringing back to life languages that have been described as dead languages, it's just been really powerful. But your story really brought that home. So that was completely, off the thread of things. But just why, I've been looking forward to this and love The Yield so much.
Oh, thank you. It means heaps. It made me cry.
I'm sorry. In fairness, your book made me cry, so it's meant a lot to me. What I'll do, you've got another meeting, so I will let you have a few minutes in the taxi as well. we might sort of, bring the conversation around.
Okay.
Where I'll sort of do a little bit of a revisit. I am speaking from Melbourne with Tara June Winch. We are discussing The Yield. It is an absolutely gripping, fascinating story told across three narratives. We've discussed Albert Gondawindi, the dictionary, this absolutely compelling weaving of language and tale. We've told of August Gondawindi's return to her home, to her family, and the wounds that are reopened and that have to heal. Look, Tara, I've just been so gripped by this. We've kind of skirted over some amazing plot points that I'm just going to encourage people. There is, you connect with ideas of land, but also the damage that is being done to land. And we don't want to open up a whole nother thread, but you really engage with the natural world and the damage being done by things like mining. What was important for you to say there about that engagement with land?
Well, the land is the mother. So when I'm talking about intergenerational trauma, when I'm talking about the children literally being taken from mothers, I need to talk about the landscape having been inflicted with those wounds too. The river runs dry in my book, and when we're in the editing stages, and I had written that the river running dry, 3 years before. And when I was in the editing stages, the Darling did run dry, and it really, I think, had such an impact on me when I was writing this book. It really made it much more important that I tell the story, and I think that's evident on the page. And my my brother also died while I was editing this book, and so I think there's a lot of heartbreak on the page, and I just hope that readers know that I've really put everything into this book. Yeah.
It's so apparent how much you have put into this book, and I'm going to say thank you again, because I can hear in your voice and I can see on your pages that this book is so much of yourself. Mundungawutara, I hope I've said that correctly, but thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today discussing the
word. Mundungu and all my Nyimara, which means respect and gentleness and kindness. Thank you.
Don't miss the best new queer cinema from around the world at Queer Screen's 27th Mardi Gras Film Festival. With over 130 films, there's something for everyone. The program spans everything from The Glass Room, an epic love story of two women trapped by war, and Then We Danced, a powerful film about a young gay dancer defying the odds, to Bit, the transgender and lesbian vampire flick for lovers of Buffy the Vampire Slayer. These and more are showing from February 13 to 27. See the full program and grab tickets at queerscreen.org.au. 2SER Partners.
Yes, you are on 2SER 107.3. You're listening to Final Draft, and I am Andrew Popel. Now, as I promised, I want to preview some of the books that are going to be coming up on the show in February. You're going to meet the authors. You're going to discover a little bit more about some of these amazing new releases. So I'm going to tease, I have an absolutely astounding debut novel from Laura McPhee Brown. It is called Cherry Beach. This arrived for me over the summer, and it's already, it feels very early in the year to say this, but this is already potentially a highlight of my year's reading. We have Miles Franklin award-winning author Evie Wilde has a new novel out. It is called Bass Rock, set in the coastal wilds of Scotland, and it has been captivating me, and on these hot days it has actually been taking me someplace much cooler. And an amazing, I don't read enough Australian sci-fi fantasy, an amazing novel from Luke Arnold. It is called The Last Smile in Sunder City, and I cannot wait to bring that discussion to you as well. February is really shaping up. We'll also have the Australian Classics Book Club coming to you. I'm really excited. It's all starting off from next week, so make sure you've got it in your diary. Make sure that you are subscribed to the Final Draft Great Conversations podcast to get those full conversations after the show. I'm going to leave you with another Australian artist. This is Chitra, and the song is called Leaving. Thank you for listening to Final Draft. Till next week, happy reading.